Exodus 3:1 through 3:22. The fourth talk in a series on Exodus was presented by David Crabtree on April 21, 1996, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1996. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
Exodus chapter 3. Every week after I'm done, people mention to me other observations, or they have extra questions or comments about the text, and not infrequently during the week as well. And I take that as a good sign. Maybe I should take it as a bad sign, but I'm taking it as a good sign. One of the things that I like about teaching this group is people are working along with me, and the way I see this is I'm kind of exploring Exodus and leading you in a similar exploration through Exodus, trying to imagine, trying to reconstruct the events that have been described by the author and the significance of those events. And so I encourage you to keep working along with me to sort this stuff out and make sense of it. The book of Exodus is a book that describes how God claimed his people. They were in slavery in Egypt, and God decided that the time had come for him to make them into a nation of his own and to lead them out of slavery and into the land that he had promised long, long ago to their father Abraham. And God raised up a man to serve as the leader of Israel, the one who would take them out. That was Moses. He was raised as the adopted son of the daughter of Pharaoh. But as an adult, he refused to identify with the Egyptians. He refused to live a safe and comfortable life as the grandson of Pharaoh, and chose rather to identify with his own people and wanted to serve in the capacity of helping relieve the sufferings of his people. In doing so, he impetuously killed a slave taskmaster, Egyptian taskmaster, and was forced to flee from Egypt. He went into the desert and joined the Midianites, ending up marrying one of the Midianites, and lived in the desert for 40 years, herding the flocks around. So now, as we reach chapter 3, Moses is about 80 years old, and God's going to give him a new assignment. A new and probably the most challenging assignment that he had received in his life. And that was, God was going to send him back to Egypt to bring the people of Israel out of slavery. Let's read the first few verses of chapter 3. Now Moses was pasturing the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the west of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a blazing fire from the midst of a bush. And he looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, yet the bush was not consumed. So Moses said, I must turn aside now and see this marvelous sight, why the bush is not burning up. When the Lord saw that he turned aside to look, God called to him from the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here I am. Then he said, Do not come near. do not come near here. Remove your sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. He said also, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Then Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. We have here an unusual account in that God is going to carry on conversation with a human being. We don't have many accounts where God actually carries on conversation with human beings. We'll see that it's not completely out of character with of the kind of thing we would expect God to say if we were to hear him speak. A bit cryptic. He isn't particularly talkative. It's not small talk. It's just straight to the point, a little bit hard to sort out. Moses is in the desert, and he is in an area of the desert. Mount Horeb apparently refers to a region. It's the region that's also called Mount Sinai. And this is an area that, even to this day, there are fairly high peaks and valleys between the peaks. And those valleys have enough water to grow grass. So it was an area that was used in ancient times to pasture flocks when grass was scarce elsewhere. Apparently it's higher elevation and not a place that they desired to go unless conditions were bad elsewhere. Apparently that's the situation here. He's leaving Midian proper and going into this area of Horeb where he's pasturing the flocks. Now, there aren't a lot of places in the world that God has singled out to be geographically significant, that the actual geographic location takes on a significance that's symbolic or religiously important. But there are a few. The first one that comes to mind is Mount Zion, the place where Abraham was to offer his son Isaac, and yet God at the last minute made provision so that Isaac did not have to die. And that is the place that is later became the location of the temple in Jerusalem and continues to be of religious significance. Mount Horeb is a similar site in that it is here that God appears to Moses in the burning bush, and it is later that God appears there over an extended period of time and delivers the law to the people of Israel. This is the place that God decides to appear to Abraham, or to Moses. And he appears in the form of a fire burning in this bush. So Moses is out doing his pasturing job, and he sees this bush that's burning, apparently at some distance, and he notices that it's burning, but it's not burning up. And being an astute observer of nature, he says, "That's weird." And decides to go over and check it out. Commentaries that I consulted as to why would God decide, this is an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a blazing fire, why would God choose a fire as a means of revealing himself? Of all the things that he could have chosen, why a fire? The commentaries seem to be inclined to go in the direction of seeing it as symbolic of Israel's sufferings. That Israel at this time was suffering, and that the fire was an apt picture of that suffering that they were experiencing. And so this was a picture of the problem that God was going to address. I'm not particularly attracted to that solution, to that interpretation of why the fire. I don't really know why the fire, but as it goes on, God's going to tell a little bit about himself. And I'm suspicious that the fire is not a symbol of what Israel is going through, but rather a symbol of who God is. that we have a fire that, fire we think of as something that is, I guess there's a lot of energy there. It's I don't know what we associate fire with. It's always fascinating. When I'm camping, we have a campfire. The thing that you notice when you look at a fire is it's always changing, but it's always the same. And it puts out an enormous amount of heat. There's something about a dynamic energy that seems to be captured by fire. In any case, I think that what's significant about this fire is it burns and doesn't consume. If it burns and doesn't consume, that means it can keep on burning. The only thing about a fire that's unfortunate when you're camping is it burns out. Especially if you go with my wife, she likes to burn wood by the cords. But in this case, the fire is burning, but it doesn't go out. And I wonder if that's not supposed to, in some way, paint a picture of God, in that it's eternal dynamism, eternal energy. But Moses decides he's going to go over and look at this bush. And God calls out to him. He says, "Moses, Moses." Now, apparently, it's not obvious when God speaks to someone. There are other accounts in the Old Testament that indicate that you have to learn the voice of God. One that comes readily to mind is in 1 Samuel. You don't need to turn here, but 1 Samuel 3. The story here is of Eli, who is the high priest at the time, and Eli has rotten sons. And the sons are taking advantage of the people of Israel, and God has obviously decided to cut off Eli's heirs, that his sons will not become the high priest. And he raises up another person, Samuel, who then God appoints to be the high priest of Israel. And at the time of 1 Samuel 3, Samuel is a fairly young man. He's probably in his late teens. And he has been given by his parents to serve in the temple. And he was sleeping in the temple. And on three occasions, while he was sleeping, he heard this voice. He heard someone calling. And he got up and he thought it was Eli. And so he went and he said, "Eli, I'm here. What do you want?" And Eli said, "I didn't call you. Go back to sleep." So he got back to sleep. Again, the voice. And Samuel gets up and goes ask Eli what he wanted. So it takes a little while, but Eli finally figures out what's going on. Verse 8. "So the Lord called Samuel again for the third time. And he arose and went to Eli and said, 'Here I am, for you called me.' Then Eli discerned that the Lord was calling the boy." So it took a long time for him to figure out what was going on, and Samuel didn't realize that it was the voice of God that was calling him. Notice in verse 1 it says, in the preface to this whole story, "Now the boy Samuel was ministering to the Lord before Eli, and word from the Lord was rare in those days. Visions were infrequent." So it's not immediately obvious to people when they are addressed by God in the Old Testament. And in this case, I don't know whether Moses recognized it immediately that this was God or not. He answers, "Here I am." And then God follows up in verse 5 saying, "Do not come near here. Remove your sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground." Moses probably looked down and he says, "It looks like all the rest of the ground. There was nothing there that distinguished it from the other ground. It wasn't marked off. There wasn't some distinguishing marker." What's curious about this is that any ground can be holy ground. What makes ground holy is God sets it aside for himself, that God designates it as holy. And that's I think of that in terms of it, that has implications for other areas of life, and in particular, who does God choose? Who does God choose to be the elect? Who does God choose to save? And it could be anyone. It's not. There aren't distinguishing markers in people. It's God choosing. It's God making. He can make anything holy. So God tells Moses, this is holy ground that you are standing on. Then he identifies himself. I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Now it's not clear from the narrative how much information has been passed down through the generations, how much they know, the Israelites know, about the God that spoke to Abraham and that took him out of Mesopotamia. I would assume that there has been a fair amount that has been passed down. My assumption is that much of the traditions of the Old Testament were preserved, if not in written form, at least in oral form, even from the time of Abraham and probably even before that. But how much did they know? It's not clear. We don't really know. And it's not clear whether this God is completely unknown to Moses, or whether this God is one who is familiar to Moses. But in any case, he identifies himself as the God who had selected Abraham, the God of the patriarchs. Then Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. This seems to be the common response when someone meets with God, is to fall down and hide their face. The picture here is a God that's... This is an awesome God in the more traditional sense of the term awesome. He really does inspire awe. I have... this is something I think that's hard for us to picture in our culture, because you would think, who would be the most awesome person in our society? Well, it should be someone like President Clinton, or a Supreme Court justice or something, someone with a great deal of authority and power. And yet, we live in such an egalitarian society that, at least in the back of my mind, I say Clinton's president because he got more votes, not because he's inherently awesome. But God is apparently inherently awesome. And I have sometimes wondered, sometimes I've tried to write out the speech that I am going to give when I appear before God in eternity. And I figured I'm going to have to tattoo it on the notes on my hand, because I don't know how else I'll get them there. But I don't know if any of you have crafted your talk yet. I urge you to hurry. But on a couple of occasions, I thought, what would I say to God? And usually it's reasons why I did the things that I did, justifications for why I acted the way I did in certain situations, and just making sure that he understands my situation and can fully empathize. But every time after I've crafted my speech, when I start to think about it, I think, you know, what'll really happen is I won't be able to say anything. I suspect that being in the presence of God will be the kind of experience where I'll be speechless. And I'll realize that no justifications are really fitting here, and no explanations are really fitting here, nor necessary. But it's going to be a truly awesome experience. I heard a song on the radio where a fellow was, in the lyrics, he was giving his speech to God, and he was blaming God for all of the evil in the world. And I listened to the song, and I thought, at first I thought it was kind of cute, and then I thought, this is blasphemous. This is bizarre, because he will never, in real life, in heaven, before God, he will never be able to say those kinds of words in the spirit in which he was presenting it. In talking before God, is someone going to be able to stand there with their sunglasses and kind of twirl them as they give their speech? I mean, I think it's hard for us to imagine what it is for someone to be truly awesome. Our society has so done away with that concept. I know that there's some Oriental cultures in the past where people would bow down before the Mongol Khan would bow down, and they weren't even to look up at the king. And I think there's something of that sense of reverence that will be automatically a part of God's being, and one that I think in our culture, and therefore in our theology, we tend to lose sight of. God is truly awesome and truly holy in a way that he tells Moses, do not come near. There is a point beyond which it is not our place to step with respect to God. He's not our buddy. Okay. The next section, starting with verse 7. And the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and have given heed to their cry because of their taskmasters, for I am aware of their sufferings. So I have come down to deliver them from the power of the Egyptians, and to bring them up from that land to a good and spacious land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanite, and the Hittite, and the Amorite, and the Perizzite, and the Hivite, and the Jebusite. And now, behold, the cry of the sons of Israel has come to me. Furthermore, I have seen the oppression with which the Egyptians are oppressing them. Therefore, come now, and I will send you to Pharaoh, so that you may bring my people, the sons of Israel, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh, and that I should bring the sons of Israel out of Egypt? And he said, surely I will be with you, and this shall be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought this people out of Egypt, you shall worship God at this mountain. So God tells him at this point what he's up to. And the first thing is, he has seen the afflictions of the Israelites. Well, it's about time, right? I mean, they've been suffering for possibly hundreds of years. We don't know how long they've been in slavery, but it's been at least 80 years, and it's probably been much, much more than that. So God has been awfully slow to recognize this. That's the way this would seem to read. And yet, in Exodus, we see God taking steps towards the deliverance of Israel from the very time that Moses is born. So on the one hand, he's announcing that now he is seeing and going to respond to the sufferings of Israel. But on the other hand, God's been at work from long before, preparing their redemption. So God is awfully slow to make it clear what he's doing, but he's been planning salvation from long, long before for the people of Israel. He says that he has heard the sufferings, and now he has come to deliver the Israelites from the power of the Egyptians. So God is proclaiming that he is going to gain release from these people who have been put into slavery to the strongest nation in the world. And God is claiming that he will bring that about. And he is going to take them to the land that is abundant with food and the things that they need. And then in verse 10 he says, the instrument for that is going to be Moses. I am going to send you to do this. And Moses' response is, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh, and that I should bring the sons of Israel out of Egypt? Now, Moses' response is hesitance, and we'll see that this hesitancy goes on for about two chapters. The way I understand this early part of Exodus is that Moses was born in a privileged situation. He was born the adopted grandson of Pharaoh. And yet he identified with the Israelites, and he wanted to do something to relieve their suffering. And so he acted in a way that didn't make a whole lot of sense. He killed one of the Egyptian taskmasters who was particularly brutal. But surely there are many more Egyptian taskmasters behind him. He couldn't possibly make a significant improvement in the lot of the Israelites by killing one taskmaster after another. It would be an endless job. So what he attempted to do wasn't really very effective, and yet it was his attempt to try to bring relief to the people of Israel. But because he had done that, he has to flee Egypt, and I suspect in his mind he's saying, I've blown it. My chance is gone. But I was unable to help them as I had hoped that I could. And a frustration. And for 40 years he's in the wilderness where he can't be of any help to his people. And I suspect what he's wondering is, what am I here for? What's my life about? I wasted my chance. My chance is gone. There's no way that I can have a significant impact on my people's welfare from the desert, and yet this is where I'm stuck for 40 years. So now when God comes to him and says, I'm going to send you back to Egypt to lead the Israelites out of slavery, his response is, who am I? He has been greatly humbled from the one who was the grandson of the Pharaoh. He's been greatly humbled. And now he's to the place where he's not sure that he's really the person for the job. But God says, certainly I will be with you. And that should be very reassuring, that if God is going to be intimately involved in this, if God is the one who's going to oversee this mission, that God is going to be the one who guides his steps, that should be comforting. God goes on to say, and this shall be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall worship God at this mountain. Now, I don't understand how this is a good sign. Because Moses will only be able to see this sign come into being, be fulfilled, after he has already led the people out of Egypt and into the desert, back to Mount Horeb, back to Sinai. So this sign is going to be a long time in manifesting itself and being reassuring. But what it's the sign for is that it is I who have sent you. Apparently it is in retrospect that God is going to present this as a sign indicating that God was with him all the way along. A reassurance that it is this same God that was with them all along. Verse 13. Then Moses said to God, behold, I am going to the sons of Israel, and I shall say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. Now they may say to me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? And God said to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, I am has sent me to you. And God furthermore said to Moses, thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and this is my memorial name to all generations. So here Moses wants to know, he says, what is your name? But there are other passages in the Old Testament where I think it is quite clear that to know the name of something is more than just to know the syllables that are the label for that person. But rather, to know the name of someone is to know the essence of that person. What that person is essentially, what kind of person that person is. When Adam was told to name the animals, I don't think that was an exercise in just attaching syllables to each species, but rather it was an exercise in studying the animals to figure out what was significant, what was distinctive about each species, and then selecting an appropriate label for each one. So here I think Moses is asking, what kind of a being are you? When he says, what is your name? What kind of a being are you? What kind of a God are you? What shall I say to them? And God's answer is, I am who I am. I'm not sure what to do with this, with God's response here. I mean, there are many, many times in reading the Bible that I wish God were clearer. He seems to always be rather cryptic and elusive. But I think that what he's pinpointing is that if there is something that is distinctive about God, it is his being. And the thing that is most distinctive about his being is that his being is prior to any other being or existence. In other words, isn't it Aristotle that talks about levels of realness? Jack? I think what he's talking about here is God is more real. He is the most real. Now let me explain what that means. If I have a dream, there are people in my dream who are doing things. And there is a sense in which that dream is real. I am having it. It does have some kind of existence. And the people in that dream do have some kind of existence. It's all in my mind, but they do exist in my mind in this dream. So they have some kind of existence, but their existence is totally dependent on me. If I, the dreamer, did not exist, the dreamees, would not exist and could not exist. And I think that God is trying to pinpoint here that his beingness is distinctive in that he is the most real being. That is, that if there's one thing we're going to pick out about him, it's that he exists prior to everything else in creation. And everything else in creation is contingent on him and dependent on him, much like everything in a dream is contingent on the dreamer. It seems to me that that would be a significant thing for God to say about himself. Because if that is what he's claiming, if that's what he's saying, then we're talking about a God that truly is the ruler over all of creation. That he's not another God competing for people's loyalties. Another God's, one God who has dominion over the lightning, another God who has dominion over the Nile River and however else they had divided up the universe among deities. But rather, he's the God over everything that exists in a way that that everything else is contingent and dependent upon him. So that's the name that Moses is supposed to relate to the people of Israel. In verse 16, he's to go back to the elders and to announce to them that the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has appeared to me, saying, I am indeed concerned about you and what has been done to you in Egypt. So he's going to lead them out. And in verse 18, he says, they will pay heed to what you say. There are a number of statements in Exodus indicating that God is predetermining people's responses to things. In this case, it's the elders of Israel, we will pay heed to you. Later on, he's going to say, I will harden the Pharaoh's heart. So one of the themes that I think that we see in Exodus is God's hands on the whole event, working things out behind the scenes. Okay. Verse 16, let me read the rest of the chapter and make just a few more comments. Verse 16, go and gather the elders of Israel together and say to them, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has appeared to me, saying, I am indeed concerned about you and what has been done to you in Egypt. So I said, I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt to the land of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorite and the Perizzite and the Hivite and the Jebusite, to a land flowing with milk and honey. And they will pay heed to what you say. And you, with the elders of Israel, will come to the king of Pharaoh of Egypt, and you will say to him, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us. So now, please, let us go a 3 days' journey into the wilderness, that we may sacrifice to the Lord your God. But I know that the king of Egypt will not permit you to go except under compulsion. So I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all my miracles, which I shall do in the midst of it. And after that, he will let you go. And I will grant this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. And it shall be that when you go, you will not go empty-handed. But every woman shall ask of her neighbor and the woman who lives in her house articles of silver and articles of gold and for clothing. And you will put them on your sons and daughters. Thus you will plunder the Egyptians. So having told the elders who this God is, then he gives the master plan. This is what's going to happen. And as he relates it, what is going to happen is they are going to ask Pharaoh for permission to go and offer sacrifices for 3 days. But Pharaoh will deny that. Pharaoh will not allow them to leave. So God's response to that is going to be to afflict the Egyptians with plagues. And he will afflict them with plagues until finally the Pharaoh will let them go. And furthermore, God is going to make the Egyptians favorably disposed towards the Israelites, such that when they leave and they ask for, they are to ask the Egyptians for jewelry and money, and the Egyptians will willingly give it up. So they are going to be leaving from having been enslaved to the strongest nation in the world at the time. They will be leaving, and they will be going from a condition of slavery and poverty. They will be leaving and going to a land of milk and honey with Egyptian gold and jewelry. And in God's words, it says, thus you will plunder the Egyptians. It's a willing plunder, but it nevertheless is God is sending them away not as losers in this conflict, but rather as the victors, as the winners, the ones that are taking the plunder. So I think that what we have in chapter 3 is a bit of a picture of who God is. God is revealing himself to Moses, revealing to Moses the kind of God that he is. And what we see is a God who is slow to act. In fact, he's so slow to act that he appears to be callous to the sufferings of his people. But in fact, He's been working right along. Things are right on schedule. They just aren't on the Israelite schedule. They're on God's schedule. It's a different time scale. And now, in chapter 3, he's beginning to act. Now he has selected the person who is going to lead the Israelites out of Egypt, and he is telling him to go to Egypt and initiate this process. And in this process, God knows what's going to happen. At every step along the way, God has already predetermined what will happen and how things will happen. Things that he has begun to orchestrate years and years in advance of that. Such that God is going to be able to bring about a truly miraculous event. I have not counted it up, but my guess is that the most frequently referred to event in the Old Testament would be the Exodus. If it's not the most frequent, it's certainly up there. It's one that is frequently referred to as God hearkens back to this time when God moved in a very dramatic way to fulfill his promises to Abraham and the patriarchs, to take the people, just as he had said he would do, out of slavery in Egypt and to take them into the promised land. So it is truly a remarkable event, one that, according to Deuteronomy, was noted by all of the peoples in the areas. And part of that miracle is taking people out of slavery and poverty and making them wealthy and blessed and giving them land and possessions that they have never had. Questions, comments?
Is it significant that he did mention Joseph's name? I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. I mean, did he just stop there? He didn't say anything about Joseph.
I don't know. That becomes the common reference to God is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. In those instances, there was only one person, one son, who inherited the promises. Abraham had other sons, but they did not inherit the promise. Ishmael did not inherit the promise. Isaac had other sons. Esau was the twin of Jacob, but Esau did not inherit the promises. So what we have there is the line of those sons that inherited the promises. But when we get to Joseph, it's all 12. When we get to Jacob's sons, the 12 sons of Jacob, they all inherit the promises. So I think that's why we have the dividing line there. We just have one person inheriting the promises till we get to Jacob, and then all of his sons inherit the promise. Yes, Stan.
You know, I enjoyed your comment. Sometimes in reading and studying, you appreciate the fact that God didn't make this very clear. Gosh, you could have done a better job, and I would have understood it better. I have a question like that, which will take us even down further. Since we already know so much of the story, my question does come in retrospect. The Jews, later on, don't appreciate the coming of Christ because they expected a warrior. Right here, the Jews are being told that they'll go to a land of milk and honey. Along the way, they think something special is coming. They were told that Christ would come as a simple being. They weren't told that they'd go through the desert for 40 years and have struggles. They weren't told. It seems sometimes that they were led down a path of misunderstanding. Not even simple appreciation of fact, but actually misunderstanding. And that struck me as unfair. It struck me as, not only did he not teach them the hard way, he promised the special way and then taught them the hard way, which made it all the more difficult, I suppose, to understand the whole matter. Well, that's one of the conundrums, I think, too, of gosh, I wish he'd made it clear, because it, would have been a little bit more straightforward. But now that I've gone through that presentation, does it not seem strange? And do you have a comment about the peculiarity and the almost the deception of the presentation? Does it struck you that way?
Yeah, I have thought about that before, and it is puzzling that God would deal with people the way He does. Because there are a number of times when it seems like if He had just been clearer, people would have responded differently to Him. I don't know if that's true or not, but in my own life, what I find myself doing is, as I realize how God says there are things out there that are coming, but in my own experience, they don't come as fast as I expect them to come, my vision kind of drops to closer to right where my next step is rather than at a farther distance. It's kind of, using the technical military term, hunkering down. I find myself just focusing on what do I need to be doing today? What would God have me do today? And letting God work out the end times and all of that sort of thing as He will. I often wish God were clearer.
Your implication is that my misappreciation of what He meant, not
yes.
So much
yes.
His deception.
Yes.
In the long run, He of course knows what's what His plan was, but
right.
I looked upon it as incomplete information.
Well, I think what I end up doing is despairing of knowing for sure what God has further down line for me in my future, and saying, well, I have come to trust God. I know that He is going to fulfill the promises that He has made with respect to me. So I don't have to worry about looking for signs that those things are indeed being fulfilled, that He's working on it, to see His hands actively involved doing that necessarily. And saying, I don't know if I'll be able to see God working, but He has shown me that He's trustworthy. I will just deal with doing what He requires of me today and let God take care of the working out of His promises. I guess that's just kind of the day-to-day technique that I found myself falling into, and I don't think it's. I mean, I think that it is realistic, given God's reluctance to make His plans clearer to me.
Along the same line, I was trying to figure out why Paul Moses tells his people you're going to go for a 3-day journey, but obviously his intention was to go for much more than a 3-day journey. Yeah. I could guess, you know, whether that was for the people's sake, that was a way of getting them out. And if they didn't have to look too far, like they didn't have to look too far, or if it was for the, that's the first time that's hit me when I'm reading that text, and that's what it's at. At first glance, it looks deceptive.
Notice in the context, those are words designed for Pharaoh. Those are what are supposed to be spoken to Pharaoh. Is that not right? They are supposed to go, the elders and Moses are supposed to go to Pharaoh and say to him, the Lord, the God of Hebrews, has met with us, so now please let us go a 3-day journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. So those are the words that are supposed to be spoken to Pharaoh.
I think Moses and the elders of Israel knew that it wasn't just a 3-day journey?
Well, I would assume that Moses knows that there is a longer journey in store. God has told Moses that this there is a sign, and that is that the people of Israel would be back at Mount Sinai.
Which would be how far?
Long ways? A long ways. More than 3 days' journey.
Didn't the elders of the people say to Moses, when they made their labors harder and didn't give them straw, they said, look, you came and said you were going to deliver us. You made our lives harder. You know, it seems like they were expecting freedom, you know, which is why mm-hmm. their hopes were dashed mm-hmm. so much.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what has been promised. I mean, that's part of the promise that was given to the patriarchs. That the descendants of Abraham would be given the land of Canaan. And here Moses is given the assignment of leading them back there. So it's more than a 3-day journey that's going to have to happen here at some point. Now, how are we supposed to understand this? Is this that this is what they are supposed to go and tell the Pharaoh? And Pharaoh will even turn this down? And then later it's going to be a more ambitious thing of the whole people leaving. Or is this genuinely misleading? Is God telling Moses to genuinely mislead Pharaoh? And as with most questions like this, I don't know the answer. But there are some... We've already talked about the midwives' response when they were told to kill the baby boys that were born. Their response was that they weren't able to do it because the Hebrew women are not as the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and they give birth before the midwife can get to them. Well, that's not being completely forthcoming. I'm thinking that it might be that we need to rethink what it means to tell a lie. You know, you always have the old question, what if you're in Nazi Germany and the Nazis come to the door and they say, do you have any Jews here? And if you have Jews there, what is the answer that you are, that God would require you to give? I really don't know. I honestly don't know what, but I'm wondering if we need to reconsider what is a lie? What's wrong? What in essence is the sin in lying? Such that we need to come up with different categories than we are used to. There was a pastor at PBC, Ted Weiss, I heard him talk once on this topic, and I don't know if I'll get it right, but someone can correct me if I'm wrong, but his perspective was you need to address the intent of a question, if, for instance, in that particular scenario of the Nazi coming to the door, do you need to address the intent of the question? And the question is, what they're asking is, do you have any Jews here that I can take away and kill? And Ted Weiss was saying, we need to think about lying in terms of responding to what is not just the words of the question, but what is the whole question? What is the whole issue? And I don't know if that's a good solution or not, because I've tried to think about how do you apply that practically. And that gets really tough. I don't really know. But I am wondering, do we need to rethink what it means to lie? Or what it means to tell the truth? Well, one of the things that's striking about the dialogue between the serpent and the woman is there's a sense in which everything that the serpent says is true, but everything is misleading. Is there maybe another category for truth such that it is not misleading, that there's something that is that it truly responds to the issue. And I think that that's probably true, that we need to think in terms of truth as truly responding to the issue, and lies don't truly respond to the issue. But I don't know how to clarify it better than that, and I don't know how it applies here. Any other questions you'd like me to answer? Yes, Patrick.
Comment on that, and then a question. When the spies came back from spying out the land the first time, everything that the 10 said was true. The land was good, but there are many people, they're big, they're walled, you know, we're not strong enough. And that was absolutely true. But yet God judged that as untrue. So along with evaluating what is a lie, you're going to have to evaluate what is the truth in God's evaluation. And I like what you said, you know, God is not our buddy. Because I've been to a lot of teachings, done a lot of people where, we're chummy, and where I'm going to walk with God, He's going to show me a miracle every day, because, He is my Disneyland. And that's flipping, that's garbage. But by the same token, God said, by this name, Yahweh, I'll be known throughout all generations. And then the Jews got such an idea of the awesome, far away nature of God, they wouldn't even mention His name. They wouldn't write it so that you could read it. So I'm wondering how they wrote that, you know. This is, my name is Blip, and by Blip you'll know me throughout all generations. You know, we can get the other way where God is so right. Far out here,
right.
And that's just as ludicrous. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we have to strike a balance between His holiness and love. The both have to be true. But I think we need to rework our models of how we put that together in such a way that I think our tendency is to lose track of His holiness in this culture, to lose track of His holiness and emphasize His buddiness. What we need to do is think of a different relationship than buddy as our model, the way we think about our relationship to God. But one that retains both His awesomeness and His genuine love for us. We need to quit for the sake of the people downstairs, but I'd be willing to talk to anybody afterwards. Thanks.